Blog Talk Radio.
Children who lost fathers this year, last year, particularly in Charleston this week. This show is dedicated to all of our people who have lost their lives in the fight against oppression.
And it has been... It's been very, this week has been very, very difficult for all of us. It's been, for me, it's been a gamut of emotions, from sheer shock, horror, rage, indignation, profound sorrow, but also one thing we have to keep in mind, you can't let anybody kill that love that we're capable of and what really makes us one as a people. And one of the things that literally brought me to my knees was listening to the victims of the parents and, the victims, the families of the victims of Charleston and their words of forgiveness that made me... We're all not ready there. We're not there. A lot of us are not there. I admittedly am not there because I'm still mad, okay? But to watch the most extreme acts of forgiveness and love, what all faiths teach you to aspire to see these people who have reached that higher ground, that was humbling. It was beautiful and it was inspiring. And, yeah, I'm still mad, but I can recognize beauty when I see it. And that was one of the most beautiful things that I've seen. And usually out of tragedy is when we see these extremes. Extremes bring out we saw extreme holler bring out extreme grace and love. So on that note, I need for some of my people to calm down. Because a lot of people are like, how can they do that? They stand there forgiving them. I can't forgive them. You can't forgive them. But we need, just like they need people like us, because people like us are going to be the ones who are going to be these warriors that are going to be out there and to do the job that others cannot. We also need people on Team Love because they are going to teach us. They are the picture of the world as we'd like it to be. And so let them do their work, and we do ours. But it's been a trip this weekend. My wife, friends, and allies, they're scared. They're really scared. They don't know what to do. And they're scared. They're lost. They don't know what to do. And don't be afraid, but my best advice I can tell them is The worst thing you could do is come up to a black person and say, "I'm so sorry. We don't want that. I'm not trying to hear that." The best thing is don't say nothing and go talk to your people. I can't put it any blunter than that.
Yeah, because, you know, this when we ended the show last week, we had a completely different angle we was coming at. Anybody that follows this show probably noticed that the title changed. Because
we do that. We have ADHD.
Yeah, so, you know, at the beginning of the week, you know, it was
pretty
all
close.
About Rachel. It was about Rachel Dolezal. Her as a white woman living as a black woman. Then we had Charleston come along. And so then the world's attention kind of went focusing in this way. But I mean, me and you talked over the week. You know, we figured there's a tie-in here that a lot of people are not gathering. There are two elements of this whole thing about race in America that ties into both of these subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and people ask me, what are the two things that are tying in, is what I've been talking to people, and I say it's white privilege and white supremacy.
Right.
If you go to Rachel, as the hashtag says, why does she identify as African American? She goes into all of this pain she felt from white America, and all of that stuff. And
there was a lot of conversations that came out. I'm going to be honest. I couldn't with the intellectual. I really couldn't, because when I heard the word transracial, I was like, okay, what the hell is this?
What is that?
Okay,
yes, what the hell is transracial?
And I figured, you know, being that, you know, I've been told by quite a few people on social media that I'm not an intellectual, and I may start to be proud to wear that tag, because I was just standing back. I thought I had to click my heels 3 times and say home, 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 because I was hearing some conversations, and the Melissa Harris Perry interview left me stunned. I mean, it was kind of a basic instinct. I'm going to be honest. My first reaction when I heard about Rachel, I was like, black folks can't have enough. You know, I mean, for this woman to come in and to take the persona of a black woman and try to, and she did pass herself off, which leads me to another part of it, the deception. You know, we heard a lot of people, we heard comparisons to the transgender community. And to me, that's apples and oranges. That is not an equal comparison to me, because what Rachel did, you know, she did it with a sense of deception. When you see transgender people going through their journey, it's done with full transparency. It's not meant to deceive or to be someone else. And my biggest problem is that it's a sense of privilege to me where she goes, you know what, I'm white, I want to be black for a day, but you don't own it. You don't own all the blackness. And if you get tired of being black, you can take that weed out. And big ups to Rachel, her hair game was fierce. Okay? You can take that hair down, wash that makeup up, and you can go right back and assimilate into the white world. We do not have that luxury. And if you want to be black, you're going to have to own it. You're going to have to own all the indignities. You're going to have to own all the beat downs. You're going to have to own every single thing. And she did not do that. And then for her to try and sue Howard University, and the rest of the story came out, I really have very little sympathy for this woman. I think she's insulting. I think it was all white privilege that made her think she can do this and that we were supposed to accept it with open arms, when it would have been infinitely more powerful if she came to her as a white woman and did the exact same thing. So, you know, that's my rant.
Now, you know, I have a slightly different view of that. Now, I understand the deception part. I agree with you totally on that. My problem was where I sympathized with her was how everybody, particularly our white allies and some of our white enemies, went in and made it seem like she had to be mentally ill to want to be black. It's like, hold on. Black people passing for white for the longest time period. And black we really have never said anything to those who decided to leave other than to call you Tom and call you a coon and let you go on about your business. We let you live and let live. You want to be white? Go ahead. When you get up, pass has been revoked. But for them to make it seem like it was some type of mental condition for her to want to be black, it's like, why somebody got to be crazy to love our culture? Why does somebody have to be crazy to want to identify with us? Why would somebody have to be crazy to want to associate with us? That's where my problem came in when it came to white privilege. And then I heard people saying, well, it's one thing to co-opt somebody's culture, which that is a privilege in itself if you can co-opt somebody's culture.
And I brought up being that God.
Right. And I used the analogy of Dances with Wolves, because some white folk act like they ain't never did this before. But I know a lot of white people who pass themselves off as Native Americans. Okay.
That was a good movie.
Yeah, but then they say, oh no, he only fell in love with the culture. I said, no, y'all miss a very important part of this movie when he is sitting there in front of the Union soldiers.
And he had a choice to make.
And he answered, and when they asked him who he was, he answered them in the Lakota language that my name is Dances with Wolves and I am a Lakota warrior. You know what I'm saying? And this, you know, and we know by watching the movie, there were some Native American men inside of that tribe that kind of didn't like him at first because he was a white man. But that particular white man came into their culture, fought alongside of them, and even died for them. Now, I had to get, you know, so now, with the fact that Rachel going back to and Howard University, this, that, another, she kind of pulled some of her sympathy card. I don't think it's from me. Because you going back to the university that gave you some of your credit, it gave you some of your ghetto pass points. You know what I'm saying?
I kind of see it a little different, but go ahead, finish.
But then the ask made me ask another question. Because this is the question where white privilege really comes in the rain, and it kind of starts us off into the other part of this universe that we going to have to delve into in this show, is what is ethnic identity? Who decides what ethnic groups exist? Who decides who you belong to? Because we heard this even about having President Obama. Us black folk, and even President Obama, we claim him. He's an African-American.
Oh, we'll claim anybody. We claim Mariah Carey. We claim everybody.
Yeah, but then you have those people who are mixed ethnic identity, who are sitting there saying, well, they feel offended because President Obama is actually one of them. And I actually remember there was a young lady who I used to work with, and she's a white lady, and she has a daughter, and her daughter is mixed race, African-American and white, and she said that she's not raising her daughter to self-identify as African-American. She's self-identifying, raising her to self-identify herself as mixed ethnicity, as being a mixed person, a person of other, which I have no problem with that, but the world is going to, in America, is going to see her as black. Because we still have this identity crisis in which we go back to that one drop rule. The government says that I am a black man. The government doesn't take any account to any other ethnic background that I may have. It doesn't look at the Native American in me. It doesn't look at the white in me. It doesn't look at the Middle Eastern in me. It looks at none of that. It only sees me as an African American man. I only identify myself as an African American man, even though I know that I have Native American roots that I can clearly identify and trace myself to, even though I know I have white roots that I can look and identify and trace my roots to, even though I know there's Middle Eastern, you know, traits that I can and write that I can trace myself back to, that I identify myself as an African American.
I look at it from a point of science. You know, at some point, you know, and there is what you identify with, and there is science. There is science that indisputably says, and there's also, you know, your facial features. There's your certain features, you know, which is based in genetics and science.
Let me put on the Palestinian headdo. Okay? And I've done this. When I was overseas, I had to be very careful, because when I wore a headpiece and I got stopped, asked for my identity papers, and when all I could pull out was my United States military identification card, they immediately told me, "We need for you not to wear that because we thought you was one of us and you was fixing to catch the beat down."
You see, you better be careful what team you want to put on the claim. But you got to hold it. But suppose you said I was Palestinian. Suppose you identified. And I have to point out. But if you identified with it, you were going to catch that beat down.
Yeah, I often had to own that ass with them, because guess what? I didn't have the proper identity paper. You know what I'm saying? And that's the same thing that we, I understand a lot of people saying with Rachel. If you got stopped by the police and they were going to give you the black woman beat down, would at that particular point in time in which you are in danger because you are black, would you at that particular point in time say, "Hold on, I'm white. Don't beat me"? Now, you know you're going to catch the beat down anyway, because they're going to be mad at you now because they thought they had them one. And you playing off like you want, so you're going to catch the butt. But are you going to own that? I mean,
right.
Seriously.
And was Rachel willing? Well, Rachel never really had a chance to own that. And, you know, I think we need to discuss the difference between identity and what genetics say. Because,
right.
You know, genetically, you have certain features that identify you with a certain tribe. My words.
Right.
Okay? So, and even though we are all of the human species, we are mammals, we are the top of the food chain. So, with that said, for myself, I'm an amalgamation of a lot, okay? I have, you know, a lot. I am mostly African-American. My grandfather was from Africa. My features are African, but I have Irish. I have French. I have German. I have a lot in my bloodline, but the dominant feature or the dominant genetic is African-American. If you were to find my skeleton, right, when they try to reconstruct, there are certain features that lend to a certain tribe. That's how they know this body is of an African American or a Caucasian. That you can't change that. You can change who you identify with, but you can't change that basic fact. So that's something we really have to keep in mind when having this discussion.
And when we talk, one of the things I want, you know, our white allies to understand is that when we use the word of white privilege, it is not necessarily, for me at least, it is not necessarily that I'm trying to vilify you or make this evil. Because every nation on the face of the planet Earth, yeah, but that every nation on the face of the planet Earth there's a dominant group. Okay? And I'm gonna use a couple of nations as an example.
You're waving dangerous waters here.
Okay, let's look at Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
In Great Britain, there are several different ethnic groups that are there. They all look alike, but they are different. You have the Welsh, you have the English, and you have the Scots. Now, the dominant group on the island are the English. Now, I know the Scots may say, hey, I don't know about that, but we all know who language they're speaking. They're speaking English. Because the Scots and the Welsh have two completely distinct languages that sound nothing like the English language. You have Gaelic and you have Welsh. They sound nothing like English.
Okay? Yes.
So you have a dominant culture on that. And people, they're probably Scots who move down to the southern end of the country, lose their accent, and will try to pass themselves off as English. I'm sure
but
they're Welsh.
All of the same race. But they're all of the,
yes,
they have
different ethnic groups.
They're different ethnic groups.
Let's take it to another nation. Another nation that was prominent in our news in the 90s. Rwanda. You have the Hutu and the Tutsi.
Mm.
Both African peoples, black, Negro, whatever you want to call them, they are the same freaking color. But one identified at that particular point in time, and I think it was the Tutsi who were ruling Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
At first, it was the Hutu who took over. It might be, and if I'm wrong, somebody just break me down because I'm not as familiar with this story. But I know that there was a dominant ethnic group, and people and I'm sure because of that, because it's human nature that. If you had features, and there were some features there, like you was talking about genetic features, that said, okay, you look Hutu, you look Tutsi. And people who had features would try to, particularly when the dominant group would try to fit into that group and say, okay, I'm not a Hutu, I'm a Tutsi. I'm not Tutsi, I'm Hutu. And that's a black nation. Then I'm going to go to Asia. Because one of the countries that we never think about having different ethnic groups is China.
Mm, yes.
Because you got to think about it. Chinese is not just Chinese. You have Mandarin. You have Cantonese.
Mm-hmm.
You have all of these different groups.
Mongolian.
And the dominant group in China are the Manchurians. The type of Chinese, the features that are most desired by people that see as beauty is the Mandarin. Because they're actually different, they're different looking. You have the same thing in Latin America. Please do not call a Guatemalan a Mexican. Or an
Man, I'm from New York. Go up to Washington Heights and call a Dominican a Mexican or something like that, they will jack you up.
Thank you. And that brings us to a whole other subject that's not even dealing with our country. You talk about the Dominican Republic, where they are stripping the citizenship of the people who are not Dominican. And when you say not Dominican, they're talking about black folk who look like Haitians.
You know, you're giving away teasers to our upcoming show.
So we say white privilege. It's not necessarily that it's an evil thing attached to it, but this is America. And in America, the dominant ethnic group that exists in our country are European Americans, white people. We speak the English language. If you are an African American, your last name, unless you're from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, the Georgia Sea Islands, or you happen to be an African immigrant, your last name is something that is European. Your last
mm-hmm.
name is Hopkins. My last name is Smith. You know what I'm saying? Come on now. How Anglo can you get?
Wait. I married into the Hopkins clan, okay? But, yeah, and that's part of now, and that's you know, there are so many nuances to this conversation that we need to have, but when you get back to all of the problems that we face, and when we talk about Black Lives Matter and the Black agenda and all of the issues that are coming out of the African-American community, a lot of it comes right back to this one, these two walls, white supremacy and white privilege. And we had two and really good examples of it. It's, you know, we've had two really good examples to it, and a lot of sub-issues have come out, like the Confederate flag issue, which, you know, it's kind of stunning to hear people go, well, you know what, I'm not going to be bothered with this issue. You know, this really doesn't mean anything because if we get rid of the flag, it won't do anything about white supremacy. And I have to say, I strongly disagree. While it will not wipe out white supremacy overnight, and once again, we have to remember there is no silver bullet that exists, and that's a whole other topic for me. You know, everybody's looking for that one silver bullet. If you're looking for that, no, it's not going to wipe it out. But what it will say, that flag flying in Charleston after that massacre in that church, in that most holy of places, and a symbol, it is the symbol of the Black church, to see that flag flying high, not even at half mast. It's padlocked up there so no one can lower it. That is a signal to Black people across America. Don't come around here. We got this. You can get big, but don't get close. You can get close, but don't get big. That's what that flag says, and that is a symbol. And ripping them down is part of the brick in that wall.
And this is one of those things that, you know, in America, we are kind of very short-sighted when it comes to historical context of some of the conflicts that we're having in our country at present time. These are not new conflicts, okay? We've been having this particular conflict that we're in the middle of now has been taking place in America since 1607. It started when the first Africans were brought off the ship in Jamestown. The whole point of how these people fit into a society that was not necessarily built nor constructed, designed to have them be a part of. Because if you talk about Mother Emmanuel Church, founded in 1818, and when I heard that 1818, because I was thinking they were going to 18, I was thinking, okay, they were going to say 1860. Because this is South Carolina now. South Carolina.
I know. My family's from South Carolina. One branch of my family.
African church in South Carolina, independent, in 1818. That the connections of this church to the slave rebellion in South Carolina in the 1820s. The fact that this church has always been the center of our rebellion, that was in the center of the rebellion that took place in the country we know as America. And as you say, that Confederate flag, and a friend of mine so clearly said this the other day in a Facebook post, that this was that flag and all flags attached to the Confederacy are flags of treason against the United States. And the reason is, here where the historical context plays into today, because the only reason, there are two reasons why we ended up in a civil war. One is because the 1% had a problem with providing equality to their labor force. Two, because the 1% could not accept a constitutionally elected president who had a goal other than to get them rich. And they decided to take up arms for it. So the historical connection to that is, if you come on now, people, we have, again, a 1% that does not see is labor force. As human beings who seek to exploit them at any chance they get, and we also have that same 1% who refuses to recognize the authority of a constitutionally elected president.
Right, and here's the problem for me, though. We keep talking about the Constitution, right? And there's a flaw with that. You know, that is supposed to be the governing document of this nation, that established this nation. And when we talk about the Constitution, I'm automatically conflicted because I want to believe in what the tenets of it say, but I have to be highly cognizant that when it was created, it did not include me as a twofer, as a black woman, as a black person and a woman in America. It did not include me. And, you know,
exactly.
I mean, you've got, you know, there's a phrase, I believe it's the Bill of Rights, that says, by consent of the governed. No, that's the Declaration of Independence. And it says, by consent of the governed. And I'm sure somebody will call in some strict constitutionalist and give us a lesson on that, whether I'm wrong or not. I know that phrase exists in one of those documents, but I believe it's the Declaration of Independence. So consent of the governed, that didn't mean that set up, that right there set up the white supremacist system and everything. So when we say it's in the Constitution, yeah, it's in the Constitution, but the Constitution was set up on a system of white supremacy. So when we talk about laws that come out of the Constitution and when we talk about the system, and, you know, because a lot of in the Black Lives Matter movement is about not only raising awareness, but we have to tear down the system that allows white privilege to engage and to thrive and grow. And it's empowered by this. So, you know, when we talk about the Constitution, it's kind of like, yeah, but, you know, and it's very, very difficult to have these conversations about the Constitution with our white allies because, yeah, it's always been there for you. It was never designed for me. And I'm trying to operate within a system that was never designed for me. And I have to learn not only how to navigate it, but to break it down and change it. And, you know, the question is, do we burn it to the ground and start over? Or are we able to replace some elements of that system and fix it? Because we have a problem when we look at laws. You know, when we talk about mass incarceration, it is built up by a system that is based on a white supremacist platform that enables it to grow. When you see the disproportionate amount of people of color who are incarcerated, who are under the foot of these laws, we come back to laws which are based in the Constitution. Your state laws are based on a state constitution, which is then in turn taken from the U.S. Constitution. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to mess with all that. That's got nothing to do with me. It all has everything to do with you. White privilege has everything to do with what's going on and so many things that we're facing that we see. You know, when we talk about, you know, corporate control, and I'm digressing a little bit, it's all occupied by old white guys. That's white privilege because they're like, I'm white. I got all the gold. This is why I get to make all the rules. That is the epitome of white privilege. So, you know, I really need for people to wake up and start connecting the dots. And we've had these incidents, and I've seen various reactions to, you know, Rachel and, you know, which basically boggled my mind, and to the Charleston massacre. And it has been mind-boggling to see people, well, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I'm done with this. I'm not done with this, and I'm not going to be done with this, and no one should, because if you can't sit there and say, I'm done with it, and then you throw your fist up and talk about Black Lives Matter. You can't say, I'm done with it. And then you talk about, I'm down with trying to break down this system of white supremacy. You can't say this. Either you're in it or you're not. And it's going to take us all into some very uncomfortable spaces. It is all going to force us all to confront stuff.
You know, and I was hoping, and I'm going to go ahead and, we, you know, for anybody that's listening that want to call in, the number is 657.
What's the number to call in? There you go.
657-383-0995. Because there's one person who's been really, really, really going out there, I mean, on her social media. And I was really hoping that she was going to call today. And I'm like, come on, where's she at?
Who, Ro?
Whoa, if you out there listening, why have you not called in? Because she talks about Alicia in America. I mean, I looked at that the first time, I'm like, wow, you went there.
She goes there a lot, and it goes over a lot of people's heads. But we feel you, bro.
And I mean,
she's probably enjoying her family today, and
I'm going to find out what she is, because I need
and
to know, you know.
Look, Ro is a doll. She's got a lot going on. But when I heard her say that, I was like, oh, yes. But Ro is a doll. And there are a lot of people in my social circle, white or black, my personal circle, white or black, Latino. I can't forget my Latino brothers and sisters out there. My Asian Americans, there are a lot of people who get it, but we have been drilled in that head. Don't say that. That's not polite. No, you can't say that. You might offend somebody.
And that's one of the things that's really, really upsetting me is because there's like two camps on the African American side. And one camp is like, you know what? We got to stay calm. We got to remain cool. And most of them are made up and led by the clergy, okay? Now, granted, clergy people, y'all usually the front line on this whole situation. Y'all usually the ones that say it'd be fine, but usually y'all one of the first to die because they end up attacking our churches. But then, what surprises me is the people who make up this other group, because there is a group who is ready to go to war.
But both sides are right.
But the other side that's tripping me out, what makes me, because usually when I'm thinking about, okay, folks that want to turn up, I'm usually thinking about my folks in the hood. You know what I'm saying? They already armed. They dealing with this shit on a regular basis. But it ain't them. It's the upper middle class African Americans that are ready to take on the fight. Them are the ones that are coming to me on a regular basis saying, you know what, the Second Amendment, we need to take a look at the Second Amendment option. And I'm like, whoa, where you going? We need, you know, I'm not saying we need to start something, but we need to be prepared to finish it if it starts. Mm-hmm. And that is shocking because everybody needs to understand this, that, and it was said today, and where did I see it at? It was a story. Was it a news story that I read that it was said? The content, yes, it was a news story, and I'm finna read it because I made a point of saving it so that I could read it. It was I'm pulling it up now because it came out of the Atlanta magazine. Mm-hmm. It was the headline was the Atlanta March and Visual to Connect Charleston to the Shooting, Black Lives Matter Movement, Atlanta Magazine. And I'll share this on the page. Hold on. I think we got Ro here.
Well, while you're looking for that,
hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Is that Ro?
Yes, it's Ro. I am so sorry, you all. I was so stuck doing some research.
No,
please forgive me.
We just haven't been talking about you. And I was like, where's she at? Because I know you've been talking about this Alicia's America for three, 4 days. And I was like, I'm not going to try to explain it because it wasn't my turn to coin. But before you go into that, there's a piece of story here that I'm reading from the Atlanta Magazine that I want people to be able to look at. This is AtlantaMagazine.com, where I'm getting this from. And they're talking about a march that they have. And the quote that I'm fixing to give you comes from Francis Johnson, the head of the Georgia NAACP. Here's the paragraph. Georgia NAACP President Francis Johnson said that office holding extremists who block hate crimes legislation should be held accountable for incidents like this week's shooting in Charleston. Quote, unquote, it is they who must answer for the lack of justice. Johnson said of politicians who do not acknowledge the connection between violence and racism, quote, unquote, the logical conclusion of racism is genocide, he said. Now, that right there is why some of the upper middle-class African-Americans are talking about Second Amendment solutions, because they understand, and we've seen this throughout history, when you have extreme racism, it usually leads to an attempt, if not, and execution of a genocidal operation.
Yes.
And we have to be prepared that we will not go the ways of the Armenians. We will not go the way of the Jews. We didn't see, for us to get caught up in that same cycle would be completely ignorant on our part, because we have history that shows when people go on to start on these type of missions, when they start doing the type of things that they're doing, that usually somebody is sooner or later going to figure out some kind of systematic way to try to wipe out the whole crew.
But hold up. In the whole discussion about Charleston and Mother Emanuel and its place in history, the one thing we have not heard about and talked about, which is very strongly linked with Mother Emanuel, is the name Denmark Vesey. Denmark Vesey was a West Indian slave who planned what was going to be one of the largest slave rebellions in the United States. In that church, Denmark Vesey was the one who said, and I quote, "We are all free, but the white people here won't let us be so, and the only way is to raise up and fight the whites." And what people need to understand is that we have tried peace. We have, when you have tried all peaceful measures, when you have marched, when you have rallied, when you have done, when you have tried to work against the odds, we have black legislators who can only get to a certain point. And even with President Obama, we still haven't seen it. People are going to look at that. This is the only thing that is left. They have put our backs up against the wall, and we are actually using the same system that they created to keep us down, to flip the script on us. So on one hand, yes, we do need to remember a peace and love and the total love and forgiveness that is what is God's love. And we do have this, but you can't ask people to sit here and watch a slow genocide of their people and then come and tell them, you know what, well, don't be mad, just pray. Yeah, you need to pray, and then you need to get up off your knees, and you need to use that anger, not in a destructive way. And I'm not advocating just random violence, go out and kill whites. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, if you come at us and you keep coming at us, hands up, don't shoot. No, we're going to shoot back soon. Because, and there's nothing I can tell I can tell people not to do it, that would not be not recognizing the history, because that's the other side of our history that we don't talk about. And it's very difficult for me, and people will say, oh, you're a hypocrite. Yes, I am against violence. I really abhor it. I had a husband who was in Vietnam. My husband would tell me stories about what he saw there. And that, if you don't know a Vietnam vet, find one. Talk to them. They'll tell you about violence and war. I abhor it.
Speaking of violence,
I'm coming at you.
I wanted to say this. I just finished doing some research and reading a wonderful book that was written by Khalees Shaquille, The Nat Turner Story. And I posted something on Facebook recommending that people read. Pretty much everything you just said, Stacey, reverence back as well to the Nat Turner story. And it brings up some great points that you just mentioned in regards to we are now in defense mode. We're not going to be attacking white people, but we're not going to lay down and let them keep killing us.
And
Nat
that's
Turner
what people
was a
need
prime
to
example of that.
And
yes.
people, you know,
and
we are so polarized. If you say self-defense, oh, you want to start a revolution, kill all the white people. No, I just want you to stop shooting me and my people. So if you pull a gun out, you may be surprised if I pull one back at you. And I don't like guns at all.
It is getting to the point. It's getting to the point in America. Again, we have to just acknowledge, first and foremost, the root of this whole entire issue with racism in this country is it was built on an Elysian mentality. Our forefathers were Elysian. Our government currently is also Elysian. Our government has failed to identify this act of terrorism due to the fact if you say he was a terrorist while he was wearing his white supremacist badges, that means all these white supremacy groups are now considered terror cells. If you consider them terror cells, that means all these judges, lawyers, attorneys, law enforcement who are part of these groups are also terrorists. Now they have to be removed from their positions. They do not want to pull the thread and unravel the hem of what's holding up the Statue of Liberty skirt tail. They do not want to acknowledge that these are terrorists and that these terrorists need to be removed from positions that they hold in office. They need to be identified and removed. But as long as our government refuses to label what a terrorist is, what he is a terrorist. They're like, well, he was a disturbed young man. Well, I guarantee you everybody that's in a terrorist extreme Muslim organization, they're not fighting because they woke up one morning and decided they want to kill people. They're fighting because they got tired of people coming to their country and abusing and killing them for no reason at all, just to take their resources. That's how those terror organizations start. So they say he got mad because a black man took his girlfriend. We're mad because y'all keep killing us. We're mad because we didn't even ask to come over here. And we're mad because we can't even assemble in a house of worship. You all have been bombing, destroying, and killing us every time we took a step forward. Y'all made sure y'all put fear in us and made us take 10 steps back. We didn't want to talk about the massacre and how they destroyed Black Wall Street. They never want us to be empowered as people. They want to live off our money and make sure that we can present capital in any way, even using us as human capital, even with mass incarceration of our men. They get our men in prison, they lock them up on charges that are even non-existent. I think they make them up like Candyland as they go, just to meet a quota for these privatized prisons. That's another part of the scheme that they're running on Black America. So at this point, call it terrorism, because that's what it is.
Right, and we
that's
saw, what
I
was
feel.
The first thing after Charleston, after the Mother Emanuel massacre, the first thing we all said, we were like, it was, we didn't even have to think about it. We were like, oh, that's terrorism.
Terrorism.
That is terror. And they were like, well, no, we don't know.
Well, what was terrorism. Boston terrorism?
And then.
Well,
Boston
struggled with terrorism, but this is not terrorism. You know, how
and
you
then, but in an example of white supremacy at work, we saw in the bond hearing, the judge.
Yeah.
When the judge, after I saw those stunning testimonies or comments by the family, and then for the judge to say, well, you know, there's two there's two sides of the family hurting, and then we come to find out, you know, the comments that the judge said about there being, you know, black people, white people, and I forgot what the fourth one, and niggas. And when
niggas.
He said that, and it was like, come on.
And that
now.
Goes back to what Rose
so
that goes back to
justice?
What Rose is talking about.
How are we gonna get justice if we have a system set up to work against us? And how we fix it, one of the things I've always said, I think for black people, what we need and who can really help us fix this is white people. Because we've been trying to talk to y'all for over 400 years.
I just have one question, because I'm not a international political guru, but I do take time
neither
to read things regarding to the Geneva Conference laws. Geneva Conference laws pretty much says this is something we've invaded other countries for this very type of situation. So what is it to say that our other brotherhoods across the water are not looking at us saying we might need to put boots on y'all ground? We're opening ourselves up to World War III.
Well, we have to be honest. The United States of America is a terroristic nation. We are bullied. We have terrorized other countries for since we climbed out of primordial mud.
You know, we talk about the what goes around comes around type deal. And the thing is, we can't go into other nations talking about racial harmony. We can't make we cannot get whites and blacks in America to get along. How in the hell are we going to make sure that the Sunni and the Shiite in Iraq going to get along? You know,
and
but going back,
but
one of the things I wanted to touch on, because see, Rose brought it up when she was talking about if you pull that thread. Because, see, now you see how the police killings tie into this Charleston thing, how it ties in what the judge said. Because, see, the one thing is, a terrorist cell does not operate in mass. Okay? We all know when Al-Qaeda attacked all of us back on 9/11, they were operating separately from each other until they came together to do what they got to do. It don't take but one or two bad apples anywhere to upset the situation. That's what terrorists do. In Iraq, who are the people who always starting the problem? It is always somebody that's infiltrated into the Iraqi police force or Iraqi army that caused a bunch of Iraqis to die inside of their barracks. So who am I not to say that the Klan, the Aryan Brotherhood, and all of these other white supremacist organizations don't have people who have been who've joined the United States military, who've joined the police force, all for the simple fact of being like a Manchurian candidate waiting for the moment the signal gets told. Just so they can start this so-called, because you know one of the things they've always wanted to do was start a race war. And people look at us when we start talking about it, this black people, oh, y'all can attack us. No, what we're telling you is exactly what you two ladies have just said. We are now in a defensive mode. We've drawn the line. And said, listen, we at this particular point, we need to ratchet up negotiating how we're going to fix this solution, because if it find a solution to this opportunity to fix America, or it is going to degenerate into a conflict.
We got
and
folks
see,
in Shaka Zulu mode.
All my people in the 1% need to understand that as much as you think a war in America might fill your pocket, it will not, because there's no such thing as a civil war that has ever allowed any country to economically progress. America, right immediately after the Civil War, were in one of the most egregious depressions that we ever had until the Great Depression of the 1930s.
That's right.
So we need to see there's going to be no economic outcome that is going to be worthy of an armed conflict here in America. So we need to be sitting down talking and dealing with this thing in the way America should be dealing with it, which is through the ballot box and inside of our legislature in a way that is diplomatic and statesmanlike. Because nobody, I don't want to take up arms, but I promise you now that if it comes to my people got to fight, I am more than ready to lead a rifle company anywhere in Georgia to defend not only the African-Americans, but to defend the United States of America against our enemies, foreign and domestic.
And to be honest, I really do not want to see that. To me, that is the last that is the last option that we have left, because all we're going to see is a lot of blood. We're going to lose a lot of people on all sides, and that really is not the way we have to go. But we are being forced into that position. And it's and you know what white people need to understand is that this is not anything new. A race war, I don't think any, I don't know about y'all, but I've been waiting for this since President Obama got elected in November of 2007, because they were 38 hot about that. I had some neighbors that lived down the street from me, and while we were hooping and hollering, you know, when he was elected, when the returns came in, they sat there, they went outside, got some clippers, and started shaving their head. And everybody on my block, we just came and looked at them and said, like, what's up? What's happening? And we were like, okay, it's going to be like this. And I was, to tell you the truth, I wonder why it took so long. I really do. And you have.
You want to know why it took so long? Because they have been building up an arsenal for this battle that they've already predetermined it was going to be a race for. They are prepared and ready. They are determined.
They don't understand. The black community is ready too. We see all this violence that's coming out of that community. You think we're not armed? They may not be legally armed, but they'd be surprised if the fight come up in the hood. Come up in the hood and pop that off and see what comes back at you. And it's going to be more than just guns. There's a piece from, if anybody's ever watched Made in America, Crips and Bloods, and there's a part where they talk about the Watts riot. And a brother sat up there, and when he talked about the National Guard coming in to quell this violence that was popping up, and your boy was like, we didn't have guns, but they were throwing everything. He said, the bricks, the funk, all the stuff that y'all left is coming back at you. And this is what white supremacy has wrought and what they really didn't think about. You know, they can come out. You can come out with a full force and firepower of the U.S. government. Hell, right now you've got local police departments who can – you get out there with your little Winchester or your little AR-15 and sit up there and talk about you're going to defend something and see what your local police department brings back at you. But I'm telling you, people are determined, and there's all kinds of stuff out there. And we are in a really dangerous place. Hell, I might die because of this. My children might die because of this.
I got a caller. Hold on. We got a caller.
Okay.
Caller?
Yes.
Hey, who are you and where you from?
Well, I was just listening. I don't even know what the topic is.
we crawl.
we turn up like that, but we're basically talking about Rachel. We talked about Rachel Dolezal, Charleston, white supremacy, and white privilege. So pick anyone and just jump on.
Well, in Charleston, black folks that's in those situations need to start strapping and carrying concealed carry. That way they can protect themselves. Anybody else, really. I mean, you women, how would you protect yourself if you was out in the street? You'd be better off if you had a piece you can pull out of your purse. You know, you can't reach into them cinnamon stockings and pull out a razor. They are ineffective nowadays.
Right. I tend to. Here's my thing on that. We saw with the Gabrielle Giffords shooting in Arizona, right? Some of those people who got shot were strapped. And my husband is a Marine. He taught marksmanship. He is a five-time expert shooter. Don't zigzag on him. He'll drop. And one of the things, people put a false sense of security in these guns and that you think that when something pops off, you're going to turn into, you know, just this, you know, you're going to turn into Jack Bauer and you're just going to start hitting your targets and all of that. When something like this happens, 99.9% of the people are either going to end up being hosted because they don't know how to react. When you get in this situation, I don't know if anybody's ever had a gun pulled on them. I have. And I'm going to tell you, the first thing you do, you're like, I mean, my first instinct, and I'm going to be very, very candid, I was scared as hell. Now, because me being me, after that pass, which was a few seconds, I was mad as hell. But that whole situation that happened, I was unarmed. I could have very well gotten shot. But if I was armed, I did not react. That time that I was spending processing my emotions, he could have dropped me right then and there.
And those
people,
right,
you know,
now,
even though you have a gun, that does not mean you are Johnny or Belinda Blaze.
And that's one of the things that you have to watch. If you're paying attention to all of those people who are very big on guns, you know, who own guns, if you look at the fact that all the shooting sports, all the training that they're doing, you're watching 8-9-year-old white kids doing timed operations in which they're shooting multiple targets with multiple weapons, reloading, moving, keep it going. You're watching them, they're training. This is not sport they're doing. They're going through military training. They're doing the same things we do, and they're shooting house. You're learning how to conceal, cover, shoot, reload on the move, so that under no circumstances do you get caught up without a round in the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And putting your head down range. And see, this is one of the things when people talk about gun control, I'd be like, no, what y'all need to do is make sure that if everybody own a gun, they need to be trained. And that's not just whites, that's black, Asians, that's Native Americans. If you're going to be out there carrying a gun, just don't go to the gun shop, go buy it, and put it in your drawer. You need to go to the firing range. You need to go to somebody professional to show you what you're doing. And if you think that you're going to use this for personal defense, then you need to go take a class in personal defense and how to use that for that.
That's the same thing applies with an automobile. You can buy an automobile and park it in your driveway, but if you don't know how to drive, what good is it going to do you? So you got to learn how to drive. So those who are going to, you can buy guns and you don't have to learn how to shoot it, but if something arises where you do have to shoot it, then you need to go learn how to properly handle the weapon.
Right. And how to deal with situations dealing with that weapon. I mean, I got a friend of mine, and I'm sure he'll take your money. That's in Franklin, Georgia. They own Advanced Tactical. They have a gun range out there, and they're teaching people this stuff.
Okay.
I mean, they're teaching a federally approved range to go teach people how to shoot and defend themselves.
But can I just drop this in, just food for thought, even if no one answers? Are we not adopting somewhat what our oppressors have done to us? Is this also the legacy of white supremacy? Are we going to say, yes, we're going to do this in order to get the system right, and then we're going to pull back and create the world that we want to be? Because I got to be honest. I don't want to live in a world where I have to be strapped to go anywhere. I should be able to walk out my door and be. The book of Genesis does not include Smith & Wesson. The book of Genesis does not include Colt 45. So at some point, yes, we may have to do this in order to be, but after we've done that, then what? Will it be too late? Will we have it ingrained in our head that we need life with guns and this is the way we have to be?
You're correct in that assumption, because guess what? That's why America's in this position that it's in today, because we tried to talk to the British. Well, the four founding fathers tried to talk to the British. The British didn't want to play ball. They sent their troops here. Next thing you know, we're fighting. And now it is ingrained in our Constitution that we need to bear arms to be able to throw off tyranny. Now, I've always wondered, France, who had a similar revolution, they don't have it enshrined in the French Constitution about bearing arms. They don't. We're one of the few countries in the world where bearing arms is a constitutionally, legally prepared, protected right. But it comes out of our belief system that we have to be able to meet anything with violence. Now, like I said, I'm the last person that wants to see a war, because I know what war does. I'm sure that, like Stacey said, her husband knows what war does. And anybody that knows what the effects of war has on minds of people and on society.
On both sides. On both sides.
We want. Yeah. On both sides. It's not nothing that we want.
Well, can I drop this? Can I drop this?
Yeah,
I want to drop something right quick. And this is coming straight from God. It says, what do workers gain from their toil? Have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful and in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can forth what God has done from beginning to end. Pretty much is saying, we have a burden as a human race to find love for our fellow man and peace. And in Ecclesiastes 3:1-8, and we go down to 9-12, it pretty much sums it up to us. God is saying everything has its time. And in due time, we have to learn from errors of our ways. We all have just gone back in time, and we talked about history. History has taught us that going to war is the last resort and should never be an option. We should be able to sit down as civilized, loving human beings and find the common thread that we are all human beings. And I think that's the problem that we're facing, because people have berated the value of our lives just because of the color of our skin. They're not looking at the content of people's character. I can honestly say race has nothing to do with who a person is. I've never looked at a person based on their exterior. I always looked at a person based on their interior. Now, unfortunately, we have so many people who are teaching hate in the cribs before kids can even talk and walk good. They teach them the mindset of separation. I even had this conversation with my daughter when she got ready to go to high school, because we lived in Lyons County, Georgia, and Lyons County has this history of being a racist community. Everybody knows that. We are out the Kendrick Johnson story at Lyons High School, how they did that. So before my daughter transitioned to high school, I said, baby, I ain't going to call her name. I said, it's going to be a big transition because you've had a lot of friends all the way through K through, not eight, that were your buds. But when they get to high school, you're going to see a total polarization to them just distancing themselves from you because you're black. I said, it's sad, but don't you distance yourself from them. And always be polite and carry yourself at the highest character. But if they choose to be that way, just pray for them and keep pushing. Unfortunately, she learned the reality of racism when she started high school, but it never existed before high school. So what I'm saying, there's a burden more on white America to acknowledge their demons than it is on us.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't have that problem because I sent my grandson to all-black high school. And it doesn't, you mean, we talking about human nature. You know, that was a time in the history of the world when black folks was beating up everybody, rule, control, had massive armies that went and, you know, destroyed other armies. And, you know, that church in South Carolina was where Denmark Vesey conspired, planned, and schemed on having resurrection, killing white plantation owners. And today in Haiti, in Dominican Republic, you got light-skinned black that's running dark-skinned blacks out of the country. So you're talking about human nature. The best defense is to always have something that you can protect yourself that acts as a deterrent from anybody bothering you. You know, down there in Georgia, don't you have a town called Kissimmee where it's required for you to have guns in the household?
Kennesaw.
Right. And you got a country called Switzerland where it's required that every person in the country have the latest in automatic weapons, and they have to prove that they can use them. So, no,
when you bring the Swiss thing up, you know, Switzerland is the only country in Europe that has not been to war in the last 500 years. Even Hitler left Switzerland alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew that was not a fight he wanted to have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Venezuela has given all its occupants AK-47. So, I mean, it is what it is. I'm sorry, that's the way life is.
We have to be ready, but we can't. I mean, here's the thing, and I go back to the all or nothing thing. There's no way that you can't have darkness, a light without dark. You will always have evil and good in this world. And it is a constant battle. And there is no way we can eradicate all of anything. We probably will never, you know, I hate when they say, when we talk about racism, we're going to eradicate racism. No, you're not. It's going to be a constant battle. It is going to be a constant mic check. When we talk about gun sense, and I had an epic time yesterday with some trolls on Twitter about it. there is no way, you know, I would say one thing. They're like, you want to take all our guns? And I'm like, personally, you know, I'm a mom. So I kind of, sometimes how I look at things, I default as a mom. And one thing, anybody who's, or as a parent, if one person can't play nice with the toys, nobody gets any toys. So to me, that's the perfect solution. Nobody gets a damn gun. But that's not possible, and I realize that. But what we can do is lessen these things, but we also have to change ourselves. Once we get past this, we have to look at the world not as it is, but how we want it to be and how it should be. And that's one of the things that all these movements out here, there's been a lot of great movements. That's one of the beauties of Occupy, which is that they were trying to recreate a world as it should be. And right now, we're not ready for that because we got to do this here. We got to figure this here thing out first. And if the white supremacist system does not realize that change is coming, and it may come in a way where there, and there will be blood, and I hate to say it, but there will be blood. If they continue on this path and it goes this way, then when we're done with that, we all need to sit down and say, we're not going to do this ever again. And and I know I will not live long enough to see that, but I want to die knowing we're on that pathway. And I really, really wish for people to understand, you don't have to be in that. If you're not ready to be in that peace, love, and forgiveness, which is the ultimate, that is higher ground. When you reach that plateau, you have reached higher ground, right? But not everybody's ready for it. But we don't need everybody there because we're going to need some folks. We're going to need Denmark Vesey. We're going to need the MLKs and Gandhis and the faith community, those men of peace, men of
y'all
peace, not of money.
Read the Nat Turner story. Read that Nat Turner
story. Right, we're going to need Nat Turner. And we should teach that. Well, of course, we'll never see that. I don't know if anybody's ever looked at the Georgia books, but you'll never find that in a Georgia history textbook. You're going to have to teach your children about this. You're going to have to look at history. Because when I heard Mother Emanuel, the first thing that popped in my head was Denmark VC. Oh, my God, what have they done? And so, yeah, you know, and it's very hard having these conversations. And I know people are going to try to call me up. Well, you said you were against guns. I am against guns. But you can't ask me to sit here and watch this, go on and do nothing. And say nothing and pray. Yes, I do pray. I pray fervently. And I remember what I was taught. But at some point, for, you know, God built me this way. And, you know, sometimes we need some archangels out there to do the work.
Yes. God gave us the power of love, but he also gave us the power of self-preservation and war.
That's right.
And that's what you have to do sometimes. There's always a time of peace and there's always a time of war. And before there's love, there's a time of hate. And unfortunately, this country just about got into that stretch.
Y'all can pray that it don't happen to you. I'm praying that I don't miss.
Say that again. You want to pray? You praying what now?
I said y'all can pray if all you want that it don't never happen to you. I'm praying that I don't miss.
Oh, well, you know what? I want you on my team, okay? I need you on my team.
You talking about the soldiers praying at that point right there, praying that my aim is true and that I always make my mark.
So we kind of digressed, y'all. We kind of went, we kind of going in gun sense territory, and I think we're going to take this up.
Y'all got a high school down there in Georgia, North High School, that's got a gun range in it.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Really?
We call it the Crystal Palace.
We have shooting teams. We actually have shooting teams.
But if you go up the street, you'll have Booker T. Washington that they can't even get key uniforms in the building because it molds in the basement. So don't get me started on that. But we call it the Crystal Palace. I forgot the total dollar amount that they spent to refurbish an old IBM headquarters complex into North Atlanta High School. But you have, and that is to me, that's one of the very, very large, obvious visuals of what the problem is in our educational system. Because I tell you what, you live in South Atlanta and try to get your kid in North Atlanta High School, and I'll see you in about 3 years, because they have made it a felony for you to put your child out of a home district, and nobody's ever said that, but I'm digressing, and we're going off on a tangent. But what do you guys think about, what do you think about Rachel and the white privilege and the white supremacy? What are your thoughts on this? Roll, caller?
My thoughts on it, being that I am a human resource person and I believe in the beautiful Title VII. However, the white privilege and our racial disparities, go together hand in hand. That's a mentality that has pretty much evolved into pure hate and oppression due to the fact white people feel that we are here for their gain financially and physically. So they don't see us in the light of being people on their equivalent level, because they've been groomed to believe all these years that we're beneath them and that we're here to create capital for their own benefit and their children's benefit. There's no benefit for us and our children in this system because it's an Elysian country.
Well, I bring my grandson to Atlanta. They're in Pine Ridge, right outside of Tucker, in Stone Mountain on a Broad Ridge Boulevard, the train with Brandon Phillips' daddy. Now, I drive over 500 miles. I do that maybe 4 times a year and stay down there for about 10 days so he can train. So y'all got a lot of good things going on for you down there. But I tell you what, if you don't work hard to maintain it and to improve it, you know, we had a black woman that was in human resources for Union Electric, which is the utility here. They had to finally get rid of her because every person she hired was black.
So we have
that problem when some of us get in positions of power and we abuse it to such a fashion that white people go, see, that's why we can't let them do anything, because they always gonna they gonna look at they gonna do the same thing we doing.
That's right. That's
guilt,
what you
them
right, because we're just. But here's the thing. When you see those black politicians who get caught doing all kinds of wild things, and we've got some stuff going on down here in Georgia that
mm-hmm.
never makes the national press, it is just wild. I mean, this is out of pocket and unhinged down here. But when you see them doing things, they're only doing what they learned from the white supremacist
mm-hmm.
system. They're only emulating
mm-hmm.
that. And I think part of the problem mm-hmm. of the black community is that we have, for years, used the European standard as the gold standard. And I think we have driven ourselves insane to some level in trying to emulate that and making
mm-hmm.
it our standard instead of forgetting our history, instead of forgetting
mm-hmm.
the blood that we descended on. I mean, you mm-hmm. see other cultures, you know, one culture you really don't hear nothing about is the
mm-hmm.
Asian culture. They ain't
mm-hmm.
trying to hear that. And let an Asian child try to fully assimilate. Their parents, they will be 38 hot, and they'll be like, no. You have to remember your culture. Latino, they do the same thing. All
mm-hmm.
other cultures do it except for black people. We go,
mm-hmm.
you know what?
Yeah,
we get rid of all of this, and we're going to emulate the white system. So a lot of the problems that we see is because we're trying to emulate the white
system. But you have to realize, for us as African-Americans, We have really no choice but to assimilate, because we were totally dissimilated from our culture. They made sure that if you spoke the same language, if two African slaves got off the same ship and they spoke the same language, they had to be separated. It was against the law and punishable by death to speak your native language. It was punishable by death for you to practice your native religion. It was punishable by death for you to do anything that connected you to your culture, so you wanted to survive. So we all done seen roots. Why did Kunta finally give in and say his name was Toby? Because he wanted to live. But what we
mm-hmm.
failed to do, and we still fail to do today, is that even though we have the resources to go back and say, okay, this is our culture, we fail to go and bring and reintegrate those things. Now, like for me, for instance, I've slowly, over the last 15 years, have been trying to infuse the principles of Kwanzaa
mm-hmm.
into my life, and particularly
right.
through the celebration of the holiday. Now, I'm not Swahili. I'm not East African.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very most likely a West African. But this is mm-hmm. the only thing that we have to attach ourselves to, because that is the Swahili language is like French. Everybody speaks it. You know, so we went to the lingua franca of Africa, which is Swahili. So we had to find. Mm-hmm. So we have to attach ourselves to those things that are positive. We even need to look at the, because there were good tribal governance, kingdoms that had good governance. And we can figure out ways to take, as African-American elected officials, to go study those things and bring those things. We don't have to include them into our state structure, but in how we deal with our communities. It will be nothing for a state legislator or a city council person or an alderman or a ward or a warden in any of these cities to say, hey, we're going to have council in my district. And you bring in everybody. And you ask them, okay, you read the bill that you finna get ready to vote to them or have your representative, and how would y'all like for me to vote? Because that's what the chiefs did with their councils. What do y'all, what decision would y'all like for me to make? But we don't do that. We do, and they tell us it's their vote to make.
Yeah, they vote by their conscience and their heart.
Right, they vote their conscience and their heart instead of voting for what I want them to vote. You know, if you look at the tribal system inside of the Native American nation here in the United States, you see that they have taken and amalgamated their tribal ways with the American system of democracy. They now elect their chiefs, but they still have tribal councils, you know, that take from the different clans, and they have representation. We have to figure a way, how do we go back in our history, pull what we need, because that's going to be the only way we're going to survive. Because like you said, inside of the European system that does not meet with us because it was designed to keep us back. Well, I ain't going to say the European system, the American system.
Yes.
That was designed to keep us down because, hell, we do better, Africans do better, an African-American will do better in Europe than they would here.
And you know another thing, you should start using the word African more. Then you won't have no white folks come along saying they want to be African, because it's quite obvious. But like that one woman says she's going to be black. Well, you know, you got a problem there, because black encompasses everything that moves, everything that sneezes. You have to use black as an adjective. You know, go to a map and find me a black land.
I see that the other way around, because anybody can be African. You could have a white person who was born on the continent of
Africa.
That's
why I said have black as an adjective. Black African. Yeah.
All right, I'm sorry. I wanted to get, Scout, you brought up something about how, you know, how we became enmeshed in this system because of, and you talked about slavery. And one of the things that you said that kind of clicked in my head was, you know, my husband, he was going to be a DI, a drill instructor, in Parris Island, South Carolina. One of the basic tenets of the military, when you come into boot camp, your main objective of boot camp is to tear you down, to remove everything that you were told, because they have to build you into, you have to be able to take orders without question. You have to be able to achieve your mission without any prejudices of your past life that may be rooted, because they're going to ask you to do things that you may have been taught were morally wrong. You have to remove all of that. So in order to do that, boot camp, what does boot camp do? Boot camp strips all that away and breaks you down so that you can conform.
Oh, yes. I remember that today. I remember, and I can tell you that it's things that still happen to me today, that when I default to what the military taught me. Not what my parents taught me, but what the military taught me. Because
this
I can remember
advocacy. We do it in the advocacy world. We have to remake you. We have to keep you, because advocacy, you can't let your position down. You have to maintain your position in order to get the best deal. You never waver. You never surrender. It's just like the military. But that's what we see done to Africans in America or black people in America. We have been broken down through slavery, through telling us we have to get rid of our culture and that we want to assimilate to reach this particular standard, the European standard. So everything that's happened since we reached these shores, I mean, look at the Native Americans. That's the biggest example. And when they wouldn't buck, they just, look, they locked them up on their own land and called them reservations.
Mm-hmm.
So when they wouldn't conform, they was like, okay, we ain't going to bother with you, because the Native Americans weren't having it. They was like, we're going to scalp you. We tried to work with you, but now we're scalping you. And what did the U.S. do?
They came back.
Right. So.
Well, if I could say, the best way to handle white supremacy is to compete against it. And I've talked to y'all before down there in Atlanta. You got a situation there that's better than it is in up here in Missouri that black people experience. Well, it is.
No, we don't.
Well, let me tell you this: blacks don't control the concessions in the airport here in St. Louis. Blacks don't have no two major construction company that's doing stadiums in St. Louis. Now, if that's all I can see, and I know there's more, and I tell you something else, I have yet to see a black woman up here in the St. Louis area driving UPS trucks. So,
I have to disagree. Atlanta is a city of illusions, where you may have black people in positions of power and who are made the public face. Don't believe that Mayor Reed is the mayor of Atlanta. Buckhead and the Buckhead Business Coalition, they're the ones who pull the strings. And the next time you come to Atlanta, look at the skyline of Atlanta and look at the skyline of Buckhead, and you tell me who runs things. They give us that to make us complacent and say, well, look.
That's what we haven't, and that's one of the reasons for somebody asked why we haven't had the outbreak of violence in the South every time something happens that you've seen in Missouri or Baltimore. Why has Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, we done had Florida, why we done had some of the same situations, but you've not seen us start burning anything down? Because guess what? The master still knows how to keep, excuse my language, keep his niggas in line. And you have it. So the moment we get to tripping, they start talking to their overseer. They start saying, okay, guys, we need to do something for these communities to make them not want to act up, not turn up, keep them calm. And they do it. The black faces come out and they say, hey, we're going to do this and we're going to do this. And it seems like it's us, but they know. I've always noticed that the town that I used to live in, LaGrange is one of those places where it should have blown up a long time ago. But every time something happens, the white folks are very quick and reactive to go in there and smooth that out real quick. Even if somebody white got to lose their head. They will do it. They will sacrifice one of their own, because you know what's going to happen? As long as we have to fight, then we're going to gain. We want them to stay exactly where they are. So as long as we keep them happy, they are okay with staying exactly where they are. And that's what doesn't happen, because you ain't seen any progress in Georgia as far as when it comes to race relations and the increase of African-American political power since the 1970s. It is what it is. Matter of fact, we are in a decline of our power structure, because they are starting to make inroads for the white politicians back into, because they are gentrifying communities that used to be African American. We got 90 seconds left in the show. I want to tell everybody I appreciate the caller. Our caller from St. Louis, I'm really appreciating you coming back, because you're giving another perspective from outside of our state.
Yes.
I like it.
And that's your name now. I don't even know what your name is, but you are forever known as St. Louis.
All right, that's good enough.
And I just want to say, I'm starting to get blown up. People think the show is inflammatory or divisive. I know. We know. The issues that we're talking about are inflammatory and divisive. So I encourage you to listen and try to gain some understanding of a different perspective that you may not always be privy to.
Right. And it's just because we're saying something that's divisive doesn't mean that we're not willing to work. We're willing to work to bring us together, but you got to understand, before you can solve a problem, you have to let people air out their grievances. And see, that's the problem in America. Nobody wants us to air out our grievances, because the fact of the matter is that the truth hurts. This is a racist society that has not willing to deal with the problems of racism in America. And until we add those, we have no problem. Well, we got 10 seconds left in the show, everybody. I want to thank you for coming, calling in and listening. This is Down South and Dirty. We'll see you again next Sunday.
All right.